From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Student loan debt has become a monster in this country. Godzilla on the loose for a lot of grads and their families. This summer, interest rates on a big chunk of federal student loans are set to double. President Obama's made it a campaign issue. The bigger issue is just the tidal wave of debt and how it's hitting lives and the country. This hour on Point, the big burden of what students borrow. You can join the conversation. Is this you up against the wall with student debt? What are the consequences? Where's the break in the rising tide? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. President Obama, not shy about looking for student votes, but talking about a really important issue in his weekly radio and internet address just over the weekend, saying that student loan debt has become a barrier to the kind of education Americans need.
Students who take out loans to pay for college graduate owing an average of $25,000. For the first time, Americans owe more debt on their student loans than they do on their credit cards. And for many working families, the idea of owing that much money means that higher education is simply out of reach for their children. Now, in America, higher education cannot be a luxury. It's an economic imperative that every family must be able to afford.
This summer, that may become a little bit harder. Legislation brought those interest rates down. They'll go back up this summer without some kind of action, from 3.4% to 6.8%. Here's the president on Saturday.
You see, if Congress doesn't act, on July 1st, interest rates on some student loans will double. Nearly 7.5 million students will end up owing more on their loan payments. That'd be a tremendous blow.
The president on student loan debt, this country, and where it's all headed. Joining us first today from Washington is Claudio Sanchez, national education reporter for NPR. Claudio, it's great to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Boy, this thing, every time we turn around and look at it, it's bigger. I mean, the headlines this spring have been more student loan debt now than credit card debt. And depending on how you calculate, maybe $1 trillion in student loan debt. This is just gigantic, Claudio.
It is gigantic. And here's a number that is pretty impressive, too. 82%, Tom, of outstanding student loan debt accrued over the last 10 years. That's a 511% increase from 1999 to 2011. And a survey by the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys warns that a student debt bomb will soon hit the U.S. economy and has all the signs of the home mortgage crisis. So this is serious.
Well, what do they mean when they say a student debt bomb? I mean, people, it's hard, it's a struggle, but it's, what's the equivalent of millions of, you know, houses in foreclosure or underwater when it comes to student debt?
Well, I've talked to economists who say that borrowing for college these days is akin to taking out a mortgage on a house. And we all know how that's turned out. You're lending money to lots of people with little or no credit, poor job prospects, at least in this economy, and no clue about what they've gotten themselves into. And again, this is why the president has made such a huge deal about this and is likely to bring it up over and over again in his reelection.
He's going to be in North Carolina this week, in Colorado, in Iowa, all at universities. The thing is, Claudia, with a home, I mean, it will cost you dearly, but you can walk away from it. With a student debt, you cannot walk away from it by law, right? There's no bankruptcy option here.
That's exactly right. You are not protected. You can declare bankruptcy, but you will still have to pay that money. And of course, the government has the power to garnish your wages and take it out of your Social Security, take it out of your paycheck. There's just no way getting around it. Tom, you know, there are many, many factors behind this crisis. First of all, you have to realize that there's been a surge in college enrollment by 6%, which is the biggest increase since 1968. That surge has been led by Latinos, 15%, Blacks, 8%, Asians, 6%. And many, many of these folks are low-income students who are struggling to just, even if they're eligible for grants and things that you don't have to pay back, but are still struggling to get that money. And of course, the price of a college education these days is still skyrocketing in large part because of state cuts. State institutions in particular, I just came back from California and the situation there is really bad. State institutions are having to rely increasingly on student tuition and fees to make up for the huge cuts in funding from the states.
So if they don't raise tuition, they just run out of cash to operate things. If they do, that essentially means very likely more loans for a lot of their students.
That's right. And the bottom line is that the California State University system, 23 campuses, last year, I believe, essentially said or rejected, turned down 25,000 students, eligible students, who could simply not, you know, the system could not accommodate. And with the situation getting worse and the governor and the legislature cutting more higher ed funding, that number is going to, again, be close to 15, 20,000 students who cannot go to school.
Claudia, we heard the president say it, but it's still a striking number that the national average now of debt carried by graduates is $25,000 for a graduate of a four-year undergraduate program. That's the average. I mean, that is a lot in itself. That also means there must be plenty. There are, obviously are plenty of students, graduates, with a whole lot more than that.
That's right. You know, if you're paying for a private school education where the tuition and fees are steeper, you're now getting lots of people who are graduating with $50,000 and $100,000 debt just for a four-year education. And, you know, the student loan default rate, meanwhile, has been climbing as well from 4.6% in 2005 to almost 9%, I believe, in 2010. That's the latest. Now, to put that in context, however, remember that in 1990, the student loan default rate was 22.4%. So there was this huge decrease for a while, but now it's creeping its way up again.
Well, why has it gone down so much, or why was it so much higher then? Could you still go bankrupt in 1990 and get away from it?
No, but, you know, back then, I think the Department of Education wasn't doing nearly as good a job tracking down the debt, getting some of these folks to, you know, to pay it back. Remember these headline stories of, you know, government going after doctors making upwards of $500,000 to $1 million. And
who had walked away from their student loan debt.
Exactly. Well, the department was accused of not going after the so-called deadbeats hard enough. But now, I mean, we're looking at a debt that, even if it's $25,000 to $50,000, in this economy, these are people who are jobless. I mean, there can be deferment from a loan that you can't pay back because you don't have a job, but that can only go so far. And I think the government is going to see this number go up and is probably going to struggle to get that money back.
So explain to us then about this doubling of interest rates on a chunk of Stafford loan debt. What exactly, which debt is that? What federal loans does that apply to? And why would it be doubling this summer?
First, it's only federal loans. There are private loans out there, of course, that this will not cover. In 2009, the Obama administration pushed through this plan to consolidate federal loans, first of all, at a lower interest rate, at 3.4%. And it was really seen as a huge break for lots of students who, you know, owed maybe a dozen or so loans in some cases and couldn't consolidate them at the time. And now that they did, you know, they lowered that interest rate, and it was a huge break right at that time when people were, again, you know, struggling to find jobs, or at least jobs with a living wage.
Mm-hmm.
But now that, since this was really a temporary measure, now the Congress has to decide whether it's going to let this thing expire. And if you're looking at 6.8%, I mean, that's going to be a pretty big increase in what students are paying back. These are mostly graduates. So it's unclear what the, to me anyway, why the politics of this are so nasty. I think it really does play into the hands of folks who say, look, we don't have the money to cover this. The debt is, the national debt is high enough. And, you know, these students may just have to live with a higher interest rate. Of course, that plays into the politics of this, and it makes the Obama administration look like it's obviously, you know, the advocate of working class as well as college student graduates. So it's good politics for the administration, whether or not it's doable, whether or not the especially Republican leadership will say, sorry, we're going to just let this, you know, expire, is a matter of waiting to see.
Of course, this expiration is kind of by design. It was Democrats who pushed it through. They put this 2012 expiration date on it, so they knew it would be right in the middle of the campaign, and now the president's out campaigning on it.
Exactly.
But, and it would hurt. This would be, I guess, for debt going forward, not for past debt, but for new loans taken out under this portion of the Stafford Loan Program. It would be expensive. On the other hand, it's expensive to the federal budget. It's something like $6 billion just to extend it for 1 year.
Exactly. The numbers, you know, they may seem relatively small, but these days, you know, this is fodder for any educational, I mean, any political advantage that either side can muster out of a debate like this. You know, the other thing is that President Obama's actually talked pretty tough about college access and affordability in the last few months. You know, he, as you may recall, he was in Michigan talking about, or warning anyway, college presidents that unless they were more transparent in their in keeping tuition costs down and guaranteeing that students got their money's worth, that, you know, he was going to tie federal aid to colleges and universities. And I don't think we had heard that rhetoric before, and certainly not from this administration. In the last few months of the Bush years, Secretary Spellings had gone to Congress to also, you know, kind of sound the alarm that college pricing and tuition was way up and that somebody had to do something about it. But it's really fallen and for lack of a better term, it's fallen kind of on deaf ears. Again, because we go back to the fact that state institutions in particular, which educate the bulk of college students in this nation, you know, they're the ones who are reeling from these state budget cuts. So it's a ripple effect and it's all tied together. I think the average person, though, has a hard time really, you know, sifting through the complexities of this to really understand what's at stake.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about student loans when federal interest rates may be about to double on those loans. We're looking again at the burden of what American students borrow these days to get a college education. NPR's Claudio Sanchez is with us from Washington, national education reporter for NPR. If you're in this huge number of Americans who have this debt and carry it, you know it very well. Some have been out in the streets protesting about it. This was March 1st. Protest against student debt took place in Brooklyn, New York, outside a J.P. Morgan Chase building. Activist Bill Tallon led a chant against the debt burden.
You have kids and cousins who want to go to college.
You have kids and cousins who want to go to college.
Sell it.
This trillion dollars is not a policy. It's lives being lived, they're chanting there in Brooklyn, New York. And that kind of passion is right around the country. Claudio, stand by in Washington. I want to go to Columbus, Ohio right now, and Sarah Steeman. She's a senior at Ohio State University, an investigative reporter with The Lantern. It's Ohio State's student newspaper. Her big piece there was, could student loans create the next debt bomb? It's at our website, onpointradio.org. Sarah Steeman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So how big an issue is this at Ohio State? I mean, after all, it's a state university. Is the debt level really that high?
Sure. Just after interviewing a few students, it's really apparent that a lot of students are graduating with $25,000, $30,000 in debt that is coming 6 months after they graduate. A lot of students are having trouble finding jobs in this economy. It's apparent that, you know, you're going into an entry-level job. You're making, you know, a meager salary, to say the least. And then you have at least a $350 payment a month. That's if you're in state. A lot of students that I have talked to were out of state. One young woman was really troubled. She had $75,000 racked up in debt, and that's just because she was out of state. She was struggling looking for a job. A lot of students on campus are taking notice of really what a problem it's become at Ohio State.
Sarah, how do you find students thinking about this these days? Do they think about it one by one? This is my problem. I'll wrestle with it. This is going to be a bear. Or are they looking at it systematically? Why are American graduates burdened with so much debt when they get out of college?
You know, a lot of students have kind of swept the problem under the rug and kind of deal with it individually. More lately on campus, as Ohio State just increased tuition 3.5% last year, it's become a problem. We just had, it was a rally for basically for college affordability. And there was about 200 students there. More so, I think that it's becoming a campus issue. Kind of students are, you know, taking notice of this outrageous debt, and they want to do something about it.
Sarah Stevens, stand by in Columbus, Ohio. Claudio in Washington. Heather Jarvis joins us right now from Wilmington, North Carolina. She's a student loan consultant, provides resources for student borrowers at AskHeatherJarvis.com. She's also a consultant for GL Advisor. That's a firm which, for a fee, so this is their business, it helps manage student loan payback options and plans. We kind of want to get some of that expertise, but it is their business. Heather Jarvis, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Well, there's supposed to be more transparency, first of all, we're told. President Obama is saying transparency or we're coming after your federal money, colleges, universities. Do you see adequate, open transparency for students about what they're getting into when they sign up for student loans, Heather?
No, not in every case. Some schools release more information than other schools do. But it's critically important that students are aware of the real costs of education, which include, you know, much more than tuition and fees. They include things like housing, food, books, supplies, and there could be much more transparency on the part of the schools.
Do you have a sense that students are going in and saying, well, this is my society taking care of me. They're lending me money to go through school. This should all be fine. Just show me where to sign. I'll sign and off I go. Do they not wake up to the burden of it until much later, Heather?
I think absolutely. I know that was the case for me. I think many students have the understanding that they're receiving financial aid, and the fact that much of that so-called aid are loans that must be repaid with interest is not that easy to understand as a young person going in. The system is not really designed to be particularly it doesn't caution folks really as much as it maybe should. And so I think many people find themselves facing a harsh reality they weren't entirely aware of when they got in.
And what about this potential doubling of federal student loan interest rates that will come about this summer unless something's done by Congress before then, from 3.4%, which sounds pretty decent, to 6.8%? Now, I guess private loans are a lot higher than that, but still 6.8% is a lot higher than 3.4%. What would this apply to precisely, Heather?
Well, this would apply to undergraduate student loan borrowers who have access to subsidized Stafford loans. So those are the federal student loans that the federal government pays the interest while a student is in school or certain times during certain deferment periods. But, you know, it seems to me that now is clearly the time to do more rather than less to make college affordable. As you said, Americans owe more on student loans than they do on credit cards, and we need an educated workforce now more than ever to ensure, you know, the success of our nation's future. It seems to me to be a terrible time to do anything to make student loans more costly and harder for people to repay.
What's the range of interest rates out there, Heather, on student loans? I mean, 3.4 if you've got a good Stafford loan, 6.8 if it doubles. Where does it go when you get into private loans?
Oh, some private loans can be as high as 15-18%, and those interest rates depend entirely on the borrower's credit worthiness. Many students, whether they're traditional or non-traditional adult learners, don't have the sorts of excellent credit you would need to get good interest rates. And private loans almost always have variable interest rates, so they might seem good now, but they're very likely to raise over time.
Claudia, this would seem like a time when we could offer, I mean, Wall Street got unbelievably low interest rates to bail itself out, and interest rates are generally low, 30-year mortgages, very low. I mean, why are we still talking about 6.8, and that's for federal and, you know, in the teens for private for loans that there's no bankruptcy exit out of? So one way or another, these are kind of guaranteed, whatever the pain of payback, Claudia. Why so high?
Tom, this is in the hands of Congress. I mean, this is something that Congress decides. And what goes into that decision, again, whether it's viewed as political or not, we don't really have a say in here. And there is, you know, the market forces really don't affect this, which is the other thing. I'm not an economist, but certainly I know that, you know, that these rates are set by Congress, and so it's hard to figure out why. I do want to come back to something that Sarah said, which mm-hmm. is absolutely true. Students are in the dark about all this. You know, they often start college not knowing what type of loans they took out, federal, private, subsidized, unsubsidized. They just take that money, And that's the problem. While in college, they really don't know how much they're paying or where exactly the money's coming from. They're, like I said, in the dark. Institutions, on the other hand, you know, they don't have to explain or not explain their real price versus their sticker price or disclose all the combinations of government and institutional loans, scholarships, grants that students can be eligible for. So what Secretary Duncan, and we have a piece later this week on Morning Edition about all this, U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan says, or has asked colleges to provide students and parents what they call a shopping sheet that would allow people to compare financial aid packages. Colleges would also have to disclose information about their graduates, whether they got jobs, and after graduating, their earnings. I mean, this is, you know, this is a time when transparency is going to count for a lot. Also, the, you know, the Federal Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is working on what the administration calls a model financial aid award letter for every college to issue. And that's an attempt, again, to deal with the notoriously unclear financial aid award letters that colleges are sending out right about this time of year.
Need some way for everybody to kind of sober up here, including colleges setting those tuition rates. Claudio, Heather, Sarah, we have so many callers here, and I want to begin to bring them in, if I may. First to Dawn in Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Dawn. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
What's your story, Dawn?
I married my dad. My first question is, how much of the trillion student loans is capitalized interest? People need to ask themselves that. I worked 3 and 4 jobs at college. I feared debt as a human being. The person I married had the loans. He was laid off for 6 months after we were married. We had 3 outstanding debts at the time.
Yep.
2 worked with us and got paid off. Federal student loans pursued us like we were criminals, told me to become a hooker. Avoidance was the only way to deal with them. The totals were $17,000 back then. Now they're $66,000. Earning 8.25%, it's always been a federal loan. Now the totals are 4 times the original principal because of the capitalization. What is enough? Since I can't get an accurate accounting of who added money, fees, charges, and interest, we have no idea where 10 years of tax refunds went to. I do know that of all the money we've paid, 0.014% has gone to principal.
Hey, Dawn, let me ask you, you got a litany there, but did they come in and grab your tax refunds and apply them straight to your husband's student debt?
Yes.
Wow. So they're pretty serious about this. Hang on 1 second. Heather Jarvis, what do you hear in this? Debt climbing from $17,000 to $66,000. To help us out here with the capitalization issue.
You know, Dawn's situation is not that unusual. There are serious collection abuses in both the federal and private student loan industries. The Department of Education uses private collection agencies, and they work very hard to collect defaulted student loans. The fees and interest capitalization can get very high very fast.
What does interest capitalization mean, Heather?
So that's when they take unpaid interest that has accrued and add it to the principal of your loan, which means you end up paying interest on interest, which is very expensive very fast. And another problem with student loan interest in particular is that, you know, when Dawn makes payments, she and her husband, it goes first to fees or penalties that have assessed,
right,
then to interest that has accrued. And so it is so difficult for any of us to really get to that principal of our student loans, which is what it's going to take in order to get the balances down and stop the bleeding.
It's unbelievable the gap between the sort of smiling face of the marketing messages from college, you know, the blandishments, come on, it's all the green quad and the rest, and it's all pretty up front, and then you've got this beast on the backside. Wow, Dawn, thank you for sharing some of that story. Let's go to Huntsville, Alabama. Roger, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am an atypical story in that I have no debt, and I that's because I made a series of choices that are available to anyone. My first choice was to join the military and serve my country, for which I received the GI Bill. That then allowed me to go. I made another pragmatic decision to attend a very small state school for my undergrad.
Yep.
And then I went to a major top 10 national research university for graduate school, and I remained debt-free. So my central thesis is, when you dig into these stories, which I find often are apocryphal, you find out of state, or I majored in underwater basket weaving, and now I can't get a job. And I believe college is affordable for those that are willing to make tough decisions.
Roger, I salute you for getting through without debt. That is great. And the sort of progression you described there, good for you. Let me just ask you, having done this, do you think American students, college students, ought to sort of practically be required to go into the military to get an affordable college education?
No, not at all, because I think my path really could have been replicated. The key, Tom, was choosing a small state school and saying, you know, I'm not going to go to Ohio State when I'm from Alabama. I'm going to go to a 2,000 student enrollment school where, in fact, I got a great education. And you could have done that and worked and probably come out marginally debt-free. I accept there probably would have, I'm realistic, I know there maybe would have been a $5,000 or $10,000 student loan burden.
Yep.
But that is not. The tales we're hearing, and we're hearing from the previous caller and that I read every day in the paper, are of these just horrible, horrific $60,000 debt loads. And I just don't see how that would happen if you wanted to go to a state school and practically select a major. Graduate school would be open to you, I believe, and even if it wasn't, I think you would come out with a much more manageable level of debt.
Roger, we've got it. I'm grateful for your call, and good for you for coming out debt-free. That's great. We're looking at student loans and what American students and grads are up against. Sarah Steeman at Ohio State. There's Roger. He went to the military, went to a tiny state school, and then gradually stepped it up. He's out debt-free and turns around to look at maybe you and your cohort and say, hey, you could do this too. Are you gilding the lily there, Sarah, at Ohio State? Did you live in too large?
Well, Tom, you know, Roger is an exceptional case. You know, that is really great that he is debt-free. You know, I have talked to a lot of students who have kind of taken the same path. They've chosen kind of programs that you can graduate in 3 years instead of four to reduce the debt cost. Also, another thing is taking credit in high school to try and get out early, and also starting at a small state college, like he said, and transferring to Ohio State or, you know, a community college. At Ohio State, you know, we have tried to reduce the cost of college, and I don't know if that's realistic or not, but, you know, that's just, there's just a few options that students can do for Ohio State to try and keep costs down.
I mean, so. Heather, do we have a kind of systematic problem here? Do students need to rethink the whole proposition, be really tough going in and say, no, I'm not going to go someplace where the tuition is whatever it is that ends you up tens of thousands in debt. I'm just going to turn away from that whole portion of American higher education.
I think that's part of the solution. I think a student should be very careful in thinking through whether they can afford to go to their dream school. I also myself don't blame those who mistakenly believe that they can access education and that that is a good plan for them. I mean, we tell our children their whole lives that education is the key to success and to contributing to society. And, you know, as someone growing up to be first generation college educated, it seems to be the message that, you know, you ought to go to the best school you can get into, and you ought to pursue the education that you're able to perform in, whether or not it's the least expensive option. But, I think Roger's right and Sarah's right. There are many creative ways that you can reduce your costs. And unfortunately, I think the reality is that many people cannot afford to attend many institutions. You know, my concern is that the well-priced educational offerings at the smaller state schools are getting more and more expensive all the time. You know, state investment and subsidies in their universities are less than they have been, and school continues to get more expensive.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're talking this hour about student loans at a time when federal interest rates may be about to double this summer. We're looking again at the burden of what students borrow, and it is a lot. $25,000, the national average for American four-year undergraduate college grads. And, of course, that means many far higher than that. But just that, think about paying that off when jobs and pay are what they are these days. NPR's Claudio Sanchez is with us from Washington, national education reporter for NPR. Sarah Steeman is here, senior at Ohio State University, works on the student newspaper there, has been writing a lot about it. You can read her work at our website, onpointradio.com. GLAD.org. And Heather Jarvis is with us. She's a consultant for GL Advisor. It's a company that, for a fee, helps manage student loan payback options and plans. She knows the ins and outs. And listen, it's not just, here's even Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank, was asked before the House Financial Services Committee in February whether there was a danger of a student loan bubble. Bernanke answered with a bit of personal information first.
Well, student loans are becoming a very large category of loans. My son in medical school recently informed me that he expected to have $400,000 in debt when he graduates from school. I don't know about a bubble per se, because going forward, most of the new lending is being done by the federal government. Now, there could be, of course, losses that might affect the taxpayer if that program is not adequately managed. So I think it does require some careful oversight.
$400,000 in debt by Ben Bernanke's own son. Of course, that's for medical school, but even so, could be losses, he says, but boy, there's no bankruptcy option here, so all those borrowers are squeezed pretty hard before it comes to a loss for the lenders here. Let's dive straight in with our callers, and our first call in this segment comes from Chicago. Chris, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for getting to me.
What do you know?
Well, I'm an attorney practicing in Chicago, and I didn't have debt coming out of undergraduate school, but did for law school, deciding to pay my own way.
Yep.
And I only took out loans that would pay the tuition at law school.
Okay.
And the way the economy is contracted and the way that the debt level is managed at the, even only at the federal level, I pay an average of 7.25% on the law school debt, and that will not change. That rate will not change for the entirety of having the student loan.
Even when others lately have been paying way, way down there. I mean, mortgages, 3-point-something%, and you know what the banks in Wall Street were paying.
Exactly, exactly. Money is available to people who have that type of credit and to banks at historically low rates, yet for students and people who are, you know, young professionals in the world, in the United States, they're unavailable to take advantage of those low rates.
And you tried to be careful. You weren't borrowing for a lavish lifestyle here, Chris. It was just tuition you were borrowing for.
Just tuition. That's right.
So what's the impact on your life now that you're out? What's the impact on you now?
Well, I'm getting married this year, and the impact on me is I'm a person that would be saving to buy a house, that could buy a new car, that could do a variety of things to help, maybe even start my own business or invest in other businesses. But the debt level that just paying the student debts is a sizable portion of my salary, and that money could be better used to stimulate the economy, in my opinion.
So what do you think about the whole system? Where's the flaw here? What's gone wrong, Chris?
Well, I think that the conversation really needs to be about, you know, I listened to some of your other callers saying, I did this without any debt, it can be done, and yes, it is, but for a vast majority of Americans, it's not necessarily practical or in their plan. What the conversation we should be focused on is whether we want to provide students and our young people with the opportunities and the skills to really change and develop our economy and our country in the coming years, or whether we will give them that opportunity and yank the rug out from under them because they're crushed with a large amount of debt trying to repay what should be something our nation should encourage.
Chris, I appreciate your call very much from Chicago. I mean, I think you got to ride it in. Sometimes you look around at this and wonder, Claudio Sanchez, you wonder if we're kind of giving, somehow we're giving our country's future over to what can look like kind of a scam, that people end up in kind of bondage for nearly life, Claudio, if they're not as you know, eagle-eyed about this as our caller Roger earlier. We got millions of people now in this pretty high-interest sort of trap, and you wonder who's setting national priorities here.
Well, first, I think, Tom, that this is all going to force parents and students to really do their homework. Going back to what Roger out of Huntsville said, mm-hmm. you know, there are options out there that can save you a lot of money, whether it's community college, whether it's a smaller school, a cheaper school. The problem is that there has to be a cultural shift here. Remember that higher education in America prides itself on diversity, on giving people all kinds of options in all kinds of schools, all kinds of settings. There is no cookie cutter approach in higher education. So people now have to realize that, you know, that's going to cost you. If you're looking for options, if you have a great environmental, you know, sciences program at the University of Maryland, and that costs maybe, you know, a tenth of what it would cost to do the same program in a private school out of state, I mean, you've got to think about that. You just can't willy-nilly say, yeah, this is the program for me, and even if it costs me more money, I think people are going to have to put more thought into that.
I'm not sure there's enough seats in this whole country, Claudio, for people to go to low-cost tertiary education.
You'd be amazed, though, Tom. There is enormous capacity, and what I'm all I'm saying is that, you know, you people just simply have to do their homework here. They do have to research this a lot more than they are already. And I think that's one of the solutions. Something else I need to add here mm-hmm. that, you know, is less well known is that, you know, higher education credits the Obama administration and its efforts to not just streamline financial aid policies, but also for offering relief to borrowers. And that's one of the big changes in this whole universe of lending and borrowing. And it's called the income-based repayment plan. That caps borrowers' monthly payments at 10% of discretionary income. And if they paid their loans on time for, you know, 20 years down the road, they still owe money, but the government will forgive the balance. It's been criticized as a giveaway. It's been criticized as, boy, you know, we're going to forgive a bunch of money. The taxpayer is going to be on the hook for it. But in the end, what many people say why this is important is because it does bring short-term relief to a lot of folks who would otherwise be paying 30, 40, even 50% of their discretionary income, like we heard from Chicago.
Yeah.
And this kind of puts a cap on it. It's a little early to tell whether it's really working that well, but that's the policy now.
Heather Jarvis, what portion of student loan borrowers does that apply to, this income earned repayment plan that would cap it at 12% of discretionary income?
Well, I'm glad that Claudio brought that up, because income-based repayment really is terrifically useful for very many student loan borrowers. It only applies to federal student loans, not private student loans. And many borrowers, particularly those who attend for-profit colleges, borrow private student loans. But income-based repayment is available now for everyone with federal student loans. The terms of income-based repayment are scheduled to become more generous so that borrowers' payments are more affordable and forgiveness begins after 20 years rather than 25, which is currently in place. That's scheduled to start in 2014 for most borrowers and sooner for a few borrowers. The details are still being determined. But income-based repayment is a critically important piece of information for those who are struggling right now with their federal student loan payments. And it raises the issue that I see as a tremendous problem, which is that, you know, student loan borrowers, both when they're in school and when they're out of school, have a very difficult time getting clear, accurate, timely information about their student loans. It's not easy to even discover exactly what you owe to whom. Loans are bought, sold, transferred.
Yep.
And it's really tricky to understand what your options are in repayment. You know, I speak to very sophisticated, educated borrowers every day, mainly those with professional and graduate degrees. And they have a heck of a time even understanding, you know, how these repayment plans differ one from another. And they don't have access to good, objective information typically.
It sounds like people could really use it. I mean, writing in online, here's Cal, who says his student loan debt for undergrad and grad school, which is apparently years ago now, is still near $65,000 when his son is now just 4 years away from college. He's been unable to get out of the cycle, you know, of that. He says, I'm scared for myself, for him, and for others in similar situations. Here's Lauren, University of Vermont, graduated in 08, $80,000 in debt, pays $655 a month in student loan payments. She writes to us, this is more than I pay for rent, utilities, and food put together. I mean, and it can feel dire. She says, I wish someone had told me to become a mechanic, because right now, with the lack of employment prospects, it seems like the only way out is jumping in front of a train. Lauren, there's a better way. Don't do that. Emily in Nashville. Thanks for calling, Emily. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I can really relate to Lauren. My husband and I are both have master's degrees. I'm a teacher, and my husband is a counselor. And we have racked up an enormous amount of debt. Mine is just from graduate school, but he has come from a lower income family.
Yeah.
And he was unable to pay for any of his school. And right now we're faced with changing careers altogether because we are barely making enough money to just provide for my family as it is. We've had to defer our loan payments because we can't even afford the monthly payments that would be probably double our mortgage.
But wow, but Emily, changing careers sometimes itself requires education, which could be more debt.
Well, exactly. That is our exact problem. The only way out right now is to accrue more debt and to get in a higher paying career, which means accountancy, drug rep, something like that, or to, because right now the income-based repayment that that was talked about doesn't apply to us because we make just above what you need to make. So it's either one of us quit our job and we live in poverty so that we can acquire the income-based repayment option, or we get into more debt to get ourselves higher paying jobs. It's like there's no win, and we don't have the answer, and we don't know what to do.
Oh, boy. It is infuriating to see how many people can be stuck in that kind of situation. Emily, I don't give up. Think your way through that thing, and I wish you luck in getting out of it. Sarah Steeman at Ohio State, what are you thinking as you hear these stories coming in? I mean, these people are further down the road. You're a senior in college. Do you see students around you thinking throughout their college years these days about how to line themselves up for viability, economic viability on the other side of graduation?
It really, I mean, these stories are painting a pretty bleak picture. And what I've kind of talked to students, you know, I'm kind of getting the same picture painted for me. I think the biggest problem is that, you know, we're in the dark and a lot like you guys were saying, you know, a lot of the higher educators just sweep the problem under the rug. We're not shown exactly what we're kind of signing up for. We just kind of sign. And one girl that I talked to, she said, you know, I'm paying $350 a month, but I don't know. You don't really know what you're paying for. So a lot of it is just that we don't see ever what we're really getting ourselves into. So that's, you know, it's not a good situation.
You may not see it, but it sees you, and it will be knocking. Beth in Statesboro, Georgia. Beth, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a college professor,
mm-hmm.
and I love my students, and my heart goes out to people who are in these awful situations. But I have to say I'm skeptical that all the students need as much debt as they really end up going into because, you know, in the small town for the colleges that I teach, the students' apartment complexes have tanning beds and game rooms and pools, and the bars are full, and they're in the restaurants all the time. And, of course, everybody needs to have some fun in college,
yep.
But I feel like sometimes they're coming more for a social experience. So it happens quite often that students will say, oh, I'm sorry, I couldn't afford to buy the books, but they're saying that while they're holding the most expensive cell phones or new designer clothes. So I wonder sometimes if a small version of an austerity plan for the students might work a little better to not get into so much debt.
Hey, Beth, I hear you. Thank you for your call, Beth. Claudia, is it possible that part of the problem is we're still living with some sort of image out of the movies from a time gone by of what college ought to be like and underwriting that, living a little bit too large with debt?
I think that's absolutely right. I think people are living in a time warp of sorts, making assumptions about, you know, what they can afford and cannot afford. Austerity, I think, as the professor is saying, is a good thing to a point. I think that we forget, though, that so many new college students, I opened by saying that the surge in enrollment is going up mostly because of minority, low-income, first-generation college students trying to get in. And these are families that have little or no experience in or advice. You know, they're not getting it from high school, certainly, and they're not getting it from parents in terms of how to shop around, how to make comparisons, knowing what they're getting into. And I don't think I see, and although I do not dismiss what the professor just said about, you know, kids holding on to the most expensive gadgets while complaining about tuition and
mm-hmm.
fees, I think that by and large, and like I said, I was just out in California, you see a lot of working class kids who are working two or three jobs and still not being able to, you know, make ends meet. I think that's kind of, that's terrible. I think that the message to American young people is access and affordability, or at least affordability, is a luxury, not a right. A college education has become a essentially, you know, based on, or is becoming anyway, ability to pay. It's not merit, and it's slowly becoming less of a need-blind system. So I think we all need to be aware that a lot of new college students are hurting, and they're hurting for real reasons.
As a nation, we need to watch out for that. I mean, we need a well-educated population going forward, but it can't be done in a way that's funneling people into a racket or going in with sort of eyes too big about, you know, how many iPhones there are going to be. Sarah, what about work? I washed a lot of dishes to get through college. Do you see a lot of students working these days at the same time they're going to school?
I sure do. Most students that I interviewed and that I know work two or three jobs. I definitely agree with Claudio. A lot of the kids who have the nicer things either, you know, are working to make those things happen, or I don't see a lot of kids who don't have a job in college, so...
Well, we will be watching as Congress looks at whether or not to let those interest rates jump up from 3.4 to 6.8%. Big impact there for a whole lot of people, and many paying interest rates much higher than that with private borrowing around the country. Sarah Steeman at Ohio State University, we're glad to have you on The Lantern there, the student newspaper, and we appreciate your time in this hour. Good luck to you, and congratulations on your impending graduation, Sarah.
Thank you, Tom.
Joining us from Columbus, Ohio, Heather Jarvis at GL Advisor, student loan consultant there. Joining us from Wilmington, North Carolina. Thank you so much, Heather.
Thanks, Tom.
And Claudio Sanchez at NPR. It's always great to have you with us, Claudio. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.